Welcome, everyone, to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host, and this is Once Upon a Time in the Outer Rim. And joining me for this and all of these fun episodes is my good friend and yours, Alex Kane.
Thank you for having me. We're no longer in the Outer Rim, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah. Well, we spend a little bit of time in the Outer Rim.
Sure.
They talk about the Outer Rim. They make reference to it. But first, Alex Kane, I have to ask you, are you related to Aliyah Kane?
I was Tuckerized. They said that I mo-capped her performance. No, I don't know.
No.
I think it was one of those things where, you know, they like to use everything from Star Wars history, like Macquarie and, you know, the rough drafts. And I think that's that Kane Starkiller name coming back, probably.
Yeah. You didn't answer my question. Are you avoiding it because you're planning on betraying me?
Yeah, yeah. Aliyah Kane is my mom. Yeah, no.
No, now I just need to worry. Was it weird to actually have your last name in Star Wars now?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. It's just one of those things that's kind of fun. You know, you see it. And
you're like, yeah. My name.
Like if there was like Marie Claire Partizag, you'd be like, oh, that's so fun. You know,
never be in Star Wars.
I don't know why I made you a Partizag, but.
I don't know why you called me that either. All right.
First Star Wars name that popped into my head, I guess.
Let's dig into The Convert. Just a reminder to like and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. You can always support the show by checking out our merch links or, of course, supporting the show through Patreon. All conversation on any app that promotes conversation helps to encourage this show. So thank you so much for those people that are engaged in the conversation. Let's dig into it. The music did a lot of heavy lifting this episode. There were some really interesting plays of some former themes that we've heard throughout the saga before.
Yeah, there's like two main cues that made me really like perk up and get excited, and it's sort of like bridging, you know, sort of episode three and then the sequel trilogy, which is fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was definitely some of Snoke's theme in there. There was a similar sort of sound to Palpatine's teachings about Darth Plagueis the Wise. So the when Pershing sort of makes his decision, there's like the choral wah. And I don't know if it was choral, like live choral, or if it was sort of using it was very low. it was in the underscore. And then we have this fabulous play of the March of the Resistance.
Yeah, that was so jarring in like a delightful way. I was like, oh, hell yes. Love it.
Like in Rebels, we got a sort of parade version of the Imperial March. And this time we get like a carnival version of the March of the Resistance. And David W. Collins tweeted out that he loves the idea that Leia stole that and turned it into something for the Resistance.
Yeah.
Like this very like Coruscantian like, you know, music or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was also a lot of like genre film noir, and you know, film noir of course is characterized by, you know, cynical heroes and stark lighting effects and sort of intricate plots, but also sort of this like dirty, like, what is the world? You know, there's also like femme fatales and temptation and dealing with sort of very hard topics. And Coruscant itself has always had almost like a layer of film noir over it. I covered this like a million years ago, talking about how especially Attack of the Clones is very film noir, and then that was picked up when the Clone Wars, anytime that they had something happen on Coruscant, there's this feeling of film noir. And in fact, it's much more apparent in this episode than it is in Andor, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, this is like a very kind of George Lucas, very Attack of the Clones take on Coruscant.
Right. Yeah. Like, and even kind of how awkward everybody is.
Yeah, sure.
It feels very George in that it is new, but it feels more like Attack of the Clones than it does, you know, say Andor.
I'm not like a film noir scholar, but I think one of the things about it is sort of this idea that you're isolated from other people in some fundamental way. You're kind of on your own. You get that a little bit with Obi-Wan and Attack of the Clones, but here Pershing is really kind of this island of I don't know, misery. Kind of like, you know, what's his name from Andor? Our little mama's boy.
Oh, God, I can't even remember his name.
Whenever we talk about Andor, I can't remember their names because I'm just so in this other corner of the galaxy right now. But Cyril.
Yeah. Cyril loves his cereal. Remember?
Yes.
Yeah. No, and, you know, a lot of people were comparing it to Andor. I feel like the writing was a little bit rougher than, say, even just the worst of the Andor episodes, but it's not really worth comparing. I think that there is some important parallels in Andor, like things never change on Coruscant.
Yeah.
And that's going to be really important to dig into as we talk about this episode. But first, let's talk about our newly baptized couple, Bo and Din.
Oh, right. Yes.
Or Dinbo. We're using their ship name now.
He like has that, like when the moment when you level up in a video game and it like plays the little music and he's like, well, I'm redeemed. She's like, you are. I saw it. You know, let's get the hell out of here.
Well, she stares at the water first a little bit. Like she definitely goes, did I actually see what I thought I saw?
Yeah. She's like, did you see what I saw? And he's like, no.
I mean, they spent a lot of time having her, poke around and say, hey, did you actually see this? Or was this something, right? So let's talk about it. Mythosaurs are essentially the mythology, the ancient mythology of the Mandalorian people, right? This is the thing that like ties them to the earth, to Mandalore, to who they are, to the creed, to everything that they represent. It being sort of buried and then uncovered because of a traumatic event, right? Mm-hmm. That's deeply psychological. That happens to us as humans. We have traumatic events that happen and suddenly something is ripped open and there's a shadow deep in our subconscious that is gnawing at us. So this is like the old buried myth that is now deep, deep, deep within the Mandalorian people. It's a sleeping dragon, right? It doesn't seem particularly interested in waking up or coming to the surface, right? So this is like hidden power from a serpent perspective. It also means that it needs to be completed. So what does completion look like for a mythosaur? If it was a serpent, the Ouroboros would be to eat its own tail. My thoughts are the mythosaur needs to be tamed. That's probably completion from a mythosaur perspective in the Mandalorian, mythology. And they also represent sort of hidden power and the right to rule too. Yeah. So there's a lot of things happening with just this mythosaur hiding under the subconscious of the planet.
Yeah. It's very like Godzilla, very Jules Verne. Yeah. I definitely think there's a king sort of theme going on in this season, this idea of
I can't
like,
stop
king.
Thinking about the show Merlin, where the dragon literally, like the Pendragon, meant because they had captured the dragon and it lived under the castle.
I never saw that show, but people on Twitter back in the day raved about how like fun it was.
Oh, it was great. Cheesy, campy. Like if you like Willow, you might like Merlin. It's got a lot of the weirdness and high drama, you know, things like that, but also fun and silly. So at the same time, I loved it. I didn't like how it ended, but that's fine. It didn't work for me personally. But there's this quote from Young that I really want to read about where I think this show needs to go and probably will be going. So even at our best attempts at explanation are more or less only successful translation into another metaphor. Indeed, language itself is only a metaphor. The most we can do is dream the myth onward and give it a modern dress. And whatever explanation or interpretation does to it, we do to our own souls as well, with corresponding results for our own well-being. So yes, the mythosaur exists. Yes, it represents the past, but the only way that it can heal the Mandalorian people is to be brought forward into the future.
I like that.
Yeah.
I also like this notion as like a writer, someone who fancies himself a writer, this idea that like language is always just a busted engine that doesn't really, you know,
fully work
right ever.
Yeah, you know, ever.
Yeah, it's not.
You're always trying. Well, you know, and that's something I have found with podcasts. I can explain things like a concept that I understand deep within myself because I've been thinking about it and it speaks true to me. And I can explain it a million different ways with a million different metaphors and somebody could still just not get it.
Yeah.
We keep on trying though. And that's the thing. Yeah. Like, I think people need to take the metaphor in, understand it themselves, reinterpret it, and dream the myth forward or dream the understanding forward. That's how you're successful. I talk about it a lot that you can only really get this stuff if you work with it, if you write. Or if you draw, create art, if you're doing a podcast, you can only really do it if you actually, you can only really get it if you're actually working and manipulating it for yourself. I am redeemed, Din says.
Yeah.
God, he was so proud of himself.
He's like, hell yeah. And then he puts some of it in a jar. It's like scientific proof of the magical, yeah. It is funny how Bo, you know, she to her, this is all like, you know, symbolic mumbo jumbo that she's not really interested in. And then she's the one who glimpses this, you know.
Well, I think
the god of the Mandalorians.
The god of the Mandalorians. Yeah, you looked into the eyes of God, Bo. But it is sort of interesting that he is like the one of faith and needs to become more rational. And she's the one of rationality and needs to become more faith. There's going to be a balance between them. Who is always between them now? Oh, Grogu.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it'll have to be kind of like Din and Bo coming together to help support Grogu.
Yeah, I like that, to get him to his next stage of what he needs to do.
He's the baby myth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does she mean to hide that she saw the mythosaur?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, to me, watching it the first time, especially, it was like maybe a little bit of disbelief, but like also this embarrassment that,
you know, I had a spiritual moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like people will fancy themselves as like very, you know, empirical, skeptical, and then they'll like see a ghost or something, right? And they're like, oh, that's really messed up. You know, so I think it's one of those moments where she's just kind of like reorienting herself where, yeah, I don't know if it's like embarrassment or
disbelief, maybe like trying to disbelieve it away. Yeah, I don't know yet. I don't know that we know 100%. I, you know, we can certainly speculate one way or another that she's just like hiding it. But I mean, I've never gotten the impression that Bo hides anything from Din.
Right.
So I don't think she's lying to him. I just don't know that she herself has accepted what it potentially means that, you know, what is it that Han Solo say? It's true, you know, in TFA, like the Force is real. Oh, the mythosaur is real. Oh, what does that mean? Does that alter my worldview? And I just don't know that she's gotten to that place where she understands what it means and so doesn't want to talk about it. I suspect she'll tell him at some point.
Yeah, exactly. I think that my sort of response to these two in this episode is that she's sort of along for the ride to an extent because she has this newfound care for Din and she's like connected to him now and, you know, she like saved him. And so there's like all that sort of metaphysical connection that happens there. And, you know, I think she wants to understand him better, even if like, you know, she's not going to go like full orthodox Mandalorian, even though maybe she's pretending like she is, you know.
I think, yeah, it's... We'll get there. I have some thoughts.
Yeah. Sure.
I did like how, you know, they did have a discussion how the chasm in the living waters was deeper than either of them had imagined. So that's, of course, symbolically representing that the space underneath the subconscious waters has way more power in it than they really gave it credit for. So the Mandalorian people are more powerful and have all of this deep, deep power in
them. Yeah.
Because the waters and the living waters represent the Mandalorians as a whole, and also Din and Bo together as two halves of the same protagonist in this season. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They're together. Yeah. And the way that Din ends up treating her is incredibly protective of both her, like her and Grogu, and also, you know, thankful, owing all
yeah.
of those.
Yeah, he's always like, Bo, you got to get out of there. Like,
yeah,
there's danger coming. Like, you know, he knows she's like very capable and dangerous herself, but it's like, you know, he doesn't want to take any risks. So it's yeah. definitely the relationship has developed a little bit.
The gamification on my Discord, that's the user's name, actually pointed out like how Arthurian this whole scene felt. Like, she's almost like the Lady of the Lake, like Nimue. You know, there's the sword, there's the dragon underneath that really made me feel like Merlin the show. And, you know, we've pointed out a lot about how this feels like almost like three Knights of the Round Table, like all of these like rogue or sort of landless knights that errant knights that are roaming around trying to figure out purpose, and how this was going to feel like bathing for knighthood or being cleansed to like sort of retake your oath. There is a lot of that. I don't know 100% what it means just yet, other than, you know, Din has some parallels to Lancelot. But we'll see. I mean, is he an Arthur? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you mentioned Merlin, and, you know, I'm thinking of the way dragons in stories, like even, you know, recent stuff like Game of Thrones or Skyrim, they kind of have this connotation of like magic returning to a world without magic, something like that. And you know, that's kind of what Grogu, like his destiny seems to be, you know, like we have a galaxy without the Jedi, which, you know, some might say like, hell yeah, it is like, but like, you know, in theory, you know, we want to get back to that place where we have like, you know, Rey training the next generation of heroes and, you know, using that stuff for good. So, it all kind of flows down that same river, I guess, of, you know, a world that was suppressed by the Empire into sort of a... Mm-hmm.
But there isn't a natural flow to the galaxy anymore. There isn't sort of a way of being with the galaxy, because the Empire kind of destroyed everything and everything's still trying to find its footing. So they go back on the ship, and Din's like, you know, you forever have my gratitude. And Bo says, hey, I'd invite you back for a feast. What did you think of this line?
Yeah, invite you back for a feast. Yeah, that was interesting.
Isn't it like you want to come back and Netflix and chill?
Yeah.
So of course, a euphemism for let's make out and have sex. Or in Korea, let's go have ramen. Come over to my house and have ramen.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, you know, the other scenes with Elia, like that's very much like a date until it isn't. So
yeah,
I like the idea.
There's pairs in this. Isn't that interesting? There's pairs, right?
Yeah, you definitely have parallel journeys.
The convert. So, you know, of course she's like, he's like, you're not going to take off your helmet for me, right? We're not going to be able to make out, so I guess you're not going to eat this feast, this Bo-Katan feast, right? So
interesting. Yeah.
This is, I mean, and it's, he's there. Like, he's like, this is the way. Okay, so yes, I have taken my nightly vows to not kiss you. And she's like, I guess this is the way. And then Grogu's like, bah, 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 which people are all like, he's trying to say this is the way.
Yeah, I don't know. That's funny. I definitely took the feast thing as like a euphemism for, you know, romantic stuff. But yeah. I don't know. I don't know, like, what Grogu makes of all this. Oh, I mean,
They could have just gone back and gone and bathed in the waters again.
just hang out in the water.
Gotten a bunch more, like, you know, hey, wait, I'll just get like a barrel.
Get a barrel. Oh my God. Yeah. There you go.
There was a euphemism in there.
Yeah.
They're pointing to something. Anyways, so they run into some Imperials. She's like, you know, you kill a couple of Imperial warlords and they come after you. This fight was a lot of fun with the ties.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, like, you know, I was a big fan of that Squadrons video game that came out a couple years ago, and this was very much like that, like, you know, sort of pushing the dog fighting imagery that, you know, George loves so much. So they're,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I did love that little joke where he says that thing about, like, yeah, it tends to happen when you piss off the warlords, or, you know, they get angry when you do this and that. And she's like, oh, now you tell me, or whatever.
Yeah, it was
like,
so cute.
They're flirting.
Sure. Yep. But he's like all obsessed with, like, you got to drop me so that I can, like, pick up my ship, my motorcycle, my space horse.
Yeah.
So I can actually fight these guys because you got the baby.
Sure. Yeah.
So she's like in this space minivan and he goes and picks up his motorcycle to go and, like, fight them. Yeah.
And he jumps out through the sky, which is sort of like an Anakin Attack of the Clones move, you know?
Yeah.
What
are we doing here? Like, what? He felt like he needs to, he couldn't protect them in the minivan, so he had to go and get his own ship. Okay.
Yeah.
They end up bombing her castle, effectively now tying Bo and Din together. She does not have a home. He doesn't have a home, i.e. his old minivan, his old Razor Crest.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're tied together because of this.
Yeah, it echoes the Razor Crest thing, which I hadn't really thought about, but it also echoes the Night of the Thousand Tears imagery that we've seen with, like, the bombers. Like, it's kind of all over again. Mm-hmm. Just that same pattern of, you know, the homes being destroyed. And
she comments how this is a lot of ships for an Imperial warlord. So do you think that this is, like, connected to the First Order starting?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I mean, gosh, like, in Fallen Order, that's, like, what, before A New Hope? That's like the Rebels era, I think, and, like, already they're like starting construction of the Starkiller base, kind of. So I mean, yeah, who knows? I think what they're gonna sort of chip away at over time is maybe this idea that, like, the First Order is just Palpatine's, like, pure, more loyalist version of the Empire that's sort of, like, always lying under the surface, you know? Kind of like the summit of Umate, you know, like under the surface of Coruscant. Like, you know, I don't know if that's what they're doing, but this idea that, you know, to be immortal, you shed your skin and renew. I don't know. This episode made me think a lot about that Operation Cinder nonsense from, like, Battlefront 2 and the Aftermath trilogy and all that stuff. I was like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know.
Without renewal, without rebirth, you are stagnant.
Yeah.
Right. You are not renewed. And the shadow only consumes. Right. So that's the problem with, like, sort of Palpatine's view of the world, is that there isn't a renewal. There's only control, consumption, and stagnation.
Yeah. And I think most people would say that Children of the Watch, too, like the armorer's whole deal is, like, same thing. Right.
Right. Yeah. It will be an interesting challenge to have Bo-Katan, who is also owl-eyed.
Yeah.
As a femme challenge in the cave.
Yeah.
We'll get there. All right. So, experiencing some insane whiplash, suddenly we are riding into Coruscant. And God, is it good to see Coruscant whenever we get to see it.
Yeah.
My question for you is, was this originally part of Rangers of the New Republic?
Oh.
Or Rangers of the Outer Rim?
Yeah. Maybe? I don't know. That hadn't occurred to me, I guess. But yeah, it's like they've got all this material of what the galaxy looks like. In my notes, I sort of described it as, like, that slow zoom out technique that happens in cinematography sometimes, where you're, like, you know, getting a total new perspective on something just by zooming out. And we haven't really done that with the galaxy in The Mandalorian. And people have been vocal about that, I think. They're like, you know, they're saving all this like galactic politics and stuff for later. You know, we get some of that in like Bloodline and
I mean, it has to tie into what the Mandalorian is all about, or it's like, why pivot the camera so far to the left, you know? But it's fine. I enjoyed this part of the episode. The first time around, I was very like confused and was like, what is happening? What is going on? What do I need to do? I don't understand. But on rewatch, it jived a lot better just to really hone in on who is the primary character. Who is the primary character they are talking about? And that really helped me. But we go immediately to the Opera House, which the last time we saw the Opera House was in Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, which is like, I think, where we see George Lucas, the man, right? Like his cameo in Star Wars is in that Opera House, I think. Yeah. So it's kind of fun. Also, the other thing about this episode is like, I think the first episode of the season was like 33 minutes. And here we have like an hour of like very leisurely paced diversion from.
Yeah.
So it is so jarring. But again, because it's Coruscant,
a long episode.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, good, Coruscant. And it looks gorgeous. And
everything looked amazing.
Yeah. And then you start to get those musical cues. I thought it was interesting how we're sort of introduced to Elia Kane, reintroduced from like over, like behind her head. And so you just see like the dark silhouette and you think like, oh, who's that? You know? And
yeah,
that was fun.
And Pershing is talking about the amnesty program as a, like, there are thousands of, like, easily 50,000 people watching him.
Yeah.
And like, not unrich people. And he's like the poster child. He's being used as like, oh, aren't we amazing? Aren't we awesome? Don't we do the right thing? Look at this grateful person. Oh, the New Republic
is like this healing institution. Yeah.
It's... Yeah. Like, aren't we great that we have figured out a way to redeem those evil Imperials?
Yeah. It's weird. It's sort of like a TED Talk in like Madison Square Garden or something. It's like like a mega church.
Well, welcome to my cloning TED Talk is what I wrote down.
Yeah.
He literally goes into all of his reasons for what he's passionate about. He lays out the groundwork of what his joy is. And his joy is taking different pieces of genetic material and smushing them together to make super creatures.
Yeah, like Jurassic Park, but for Snokes, potentially.
Yeah, and I want to say, like, we have gene editing as human now.
Sure. Like, yeah.
CRISPR is a gene editor, and we have the ability to take aspects of different animals and put them together with other animals to make medications and to make different things that can help with treats. So, as an example, you know, immune disorders have several treatments that involve using rat or mouse proteins that have been edited into the genes of human proteins to help basically tell the immune system to stop attacking the body, which happens with immune disorders. And so this is not something that is like even science fiction. It happened. It's the cloning. It's probably more of the plot lines in The Bad Batch that are being told right now. You know, they can create new replicas with that are even cooler and stronger because of the Kaminoan technology. And this is something that is very like Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Taking the pieces of each other. At least that's how it's framed in the episode. He talks about why he likes to do this, which is that, you know, his mother's heart gave out on her. But he talks about that. And then his hand goes up to his ear and he puts his, it's like a tell, like in poker, like he's lying.
Yeah, I caught that.
And then he says, people question whether my intentions were good. So which was it? Was it that his mother's heart gave out on her, who was a doctor in a small village, or was his intentions not good? Which is his conscience telling us?
It's fascinating because he's always portrayed, he's very, he insists upon his goodness. What is it? Virtue signaling? You know, like in The Sin, I think, the third episode of The Mandalorian.
I'm just trying to help.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I love that little guy. I wasn't going to hurt Grogu. Like, you know, I'm just a doctor, you know. And yeah, I think that the more he protests, the more suspicious we become, right?
He recognizes that it's not something that the New Republic would allow.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't take much to get him to sort of change his path. He's pretty easy to manipulate back to, you know, there's not a lot of arm twisting going on, really.
Right.
It's all good.
Yeah, exactly. So he wraps up his talk and he's surrounded by sort of sycophants and the fashionably rich. These were totally rich liberals.
Yeah, people for whom politics is kind of like just sports or the newspaper. It's not like their daily lives are really affected.
They have
so
much money. They will be unaffected by regime change. Literally, they say Empire, Rebels, New Republic. I can't keep track. It's very much the people that like DJ was warning Rose and Finn about, right?
Yeah.
It's the other side of the coin. This is the truth. The things don't really change for those with wealth.
Yeah. A lot of people that I admire, people on Star Wars Twitter probably admire. I remember when you know, Joe Biden was either about to be elected or after he was elected instead of Trump, you know, the sentiment was, I'm so relieved I can go back to not paying attention to politics. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the most evil, depressing thing in the world. A lot of like, you know, people that you wouldn't want to see have that mentality said that. And I think that's what this is. It's that idea that I have enough money and power that I can ignore it and I will be fine. To hell with immigrants and trans people and you know, poor people, you name it, right?
The woman literally says it, we try not to get involved.
Yeah.
Right? Like, isn't that wild? This isn't a Star Wars show. I found this wild.
Yeah.
Like, and actually this line itself is quite striking.
Yeah. I think the Andor comparisons are fair, even if it's like the audience, like the target audience here is probably a different one than Andor. Mm-hmm. Like the comparisons make sense. And it is nice to see them.
I don't know that it's shooting executed as well as Andor. But what it's trying to say is, yeah, exactly the same.
Yeah. Same ballpark for sure. And it's I like how it's playing with themes from Revenge of the Sith, you know, by restating them in a different way.
Also TLJ, right? With, you know, Canto Bite and all of those rich people that basically don't care. And like, that's one of the problems with people who are extremely wealthy is that they will just keep in power the people that keep them extremely wealthy, even if it means others suffer.
Yeah.
Billionaires make millionaires to prop themselves up. It's all fiefdoms in the end. We live under feudalism. It's just the power of the day is capitalism.
Yeah.
These rich people don't care because they don't care and they don't need to care.
Yeah. They can comfortably vote for whoever gives them the best tax
break. Exactly.
So depressing.
And then they can also, you know, pay for political confusion. So people who don't have a good grasp on what this genuinely means for other people will vote for the people that will make them suffer. It's hard. This was in this show. What the hell?
Yeah.
He's in the taxi home and I love this like taxi droid who's like, I see you're going to Amnesty Housing. Have you checked out the holographic museum of all the extinct animals? That's depressing.
Yeah, that's a very, you pointed out the film noir thing.
Yeah.
That's a very Blade Runner moment, that idea
and Blade Runner is like techno noir.
Right. Yeah. Tech noir. Exactly. And like the book that Blade Runner is based on. It's like all
Philip K. Dick. There's a lot of Philip K. Dick in this. There's like people have been being like THX 1138, but I actually think it's more Philip K. Dick. Like Blade Runner, So Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Total Recall. There's a lot of that. Like, what if this technology existed?
Yeah.
And I how feel like dark the, it becomes.
You've got the themes of like, yeah, the sort of replacement animals, like the, you know, the, I guess they're android animals that have replaced the ones that were killed off in like nuclear wars. That's where you get the electric sheep title. And then, yeah, like all that stuff about like genetic engineering and eugenics
And Total Recall was like, if you erase the person's memory completely, or the original short story from Philip K. Dick was, we can store it for you wholesale.
Yeah.
And so like the idea was like, he is a completely different person because all of his memories were taken away and put into a different place, but he still has, like, he is still him to the world.
Wow. And the mind flayer, to jump ahead, but that's like such a Total Recall image. For sure.
Yeah, I was thinking it was totally Philip K. Dick, and nobody else was talking about it on the internet. Am I weird?
I mean, I'm one of those guys who like always goes back to Philip K. Dick because that's like who I really admired in college as like a reader. And so I get excited when like Rian Johnson will be like, oh, I went through a big Philip K. Dick phase. And I think every writer does that because Dick was just kind of such a weird genius guy who
And like, you know, reading his short stories is hard because they're not like, they weren't very well edited when they were originally released. And so sometimes he like changes people's names and stuff like that. But the ideas are so brilliant. I remember there's this like short story about these kids that are given this game that basically encourages cooperation. But the people who gave the game were actually the aliens that wanted to like basically take over Earth. So all these kids like were all about cooperation and wouldn't fight back against the aliens.
Yeah.
It was like the long game.
he was a guy who like his heroes were the ordinary person who did like one significant act for good, you know, and he's very suspicious of reality, which is the vibe in this episode kind of with Elia Kane, you know, like what is going on here,
and what is the truth by which we should be holding up our ideals to? There's whole episode is disconcerting to me. I don't know if I said that up at the top, but like I literally felt so weird. I think I messaged you. I'm like, what a weird little episode when it's like an hour long. But I was just like, what is trying to be said? And it's taken me like over a day to like really suss it out. And I don't know if I have all the answers yet, but I'm talking it out with you because of it. But this, as he's in this taxi and the taxi driver's talking about Coruscant, I don't know if you know this, Alex, but I recently went to Washington, D.C. to visit a friend.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
And a couple of friends, actually. But specifically, we went around to all of the free museum and literally, except for maybe like a couple of museums that have a cost because they're not part of the Smithsonian organization, all of the museums, all the monuments are free. It's like it's a show, right? It's to show the idea of what the Republic is supposed to represent. Look at all of these amazing things that you can do. Look at all of these opportunities that you have. Like the city itself is kept really, really clean. Everybody kind of has all of these fun activities to do, and there's lots of schmoozing and lots of entertainment, and people are not real to each other because it is a fake city. It's a fake place that people go to. It's all affectation and not real. There isn't a way to touch the earth with your hand, as we see later.
Yeah.
He arrives back at the Amnesty housing and he runs into four people who are sitting around drinking alcoholic milk, maybe.
Yeah, it's like cloudy white. Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. I liked how they had like, I don't know, they kind of looked like, I don't know, like hard liquor shots or something.
Yeah, that's what I took it to be. But yeah, it looks more like medicine you'd get if you had like, I don't know, some kind of throat, what, like bronchitis or something.
And they're chatting, and he sees G-68, who later is revealed to be Elia Kane, who's from Gideon's ship. And I wrote down, don't you hate it when you run into somebody from high school?
Yeah.
You're like, wait, do we need to talk? Do we need to like reminisce? Do we need to, or do we even have the same politics anymore? Do we, you know?
And it's like, she's got this like cool confidence, and he's like an animal ready to flee, you know? The vibe I get from this episode, I have all these weird fan theories that this episode conjured for me that I'll touch on later, but I feel like the vibe is that she was a person of like immense power.
Oh my God, I have the same thoughts. Like later.
I think that he is terrified of her because he, you know, knows more than we do about her.
I don't know that he actually knows anything about her, but I do think that she exudes my parents were in the opera house, because how the hell did she get seats to the opera house?
To me, she is potentially this show's Palpatine, like a person of immense manipulative power, and you're saying also privilege too, maybe, which is a fun Palpatine combination.
I don't know yet, but like there's this vibe. I don't either. There's this vibe I have that she grew up with privilege and was like, went to the academy for whatever reason, because kids crave adventure, right? They think about Luke. Luke almost joined the academy.
Right.
Luke was almost an Imperial, except for Uncle Owen, which he gets so much crap, but he kept that kid out of the Imperial Academy. By saying one more season, you gotta stay around.
Joel Edgerton has done a lot to rehabilitate Owen Lars, and I love that. I love that character now. Always loved Beru, but now I love Owen too. So good on him.
He's a hard farmer. Okay.
Yeah.
But they talk about how, Gideon, I heard he escaped from his war tribunal. You hear this in the background as he's like making eyes at G-68, and, that was just a cover for the fact that they hooked him up to a mind flare. Okay, let's talk about mind flare. This is a D&D reference.
Yeah, got used in like Stranger Things as like
it's the Illithid, who they're super intelligent man-shaped creatures with tentacles that for mouths, and basically they eat your brain, they eat your intelligence, they eat your brain when they get a hold of you. And of course this is the threat of consumption, that something is brewing deep within the Republic that will eat you alive if you do not behave. And you know, it's framed in this like weird like toast, long live the Republic.
Yeah,
you know, you wouldn't have caught them like redeeming people in the Empire.
Yeah.
And immediately we're brought into kind of like this really interesting conversation with G-68 with have you taken in much of course?
Yeah. I very much in my notes I put she's a lot like when Anakin arrived at Coruscant as like a small child, and Palpatine's like, you know, oh, I'm gonna take you under my wing, little bird. Like,
yeah,
she's totally playing that role in this episode.
And then they ask him like, yeah, do you miss anything? Like, you know, I have a question for you before we get into the, like the biscuits thing, which is so cool. Do these four people work together? Like, is this a trap from the beginning?
Work together.
They all like amnesty officers that are just hanging out, trying to catch susceptible people?
Interesting. Because that didn't occur to me.
They all know each other and they all talk about things, and they're all like, they back off like, oh, well, of course you don't miss being a fascist, but you know, do you miss like the armor or the uniform?
Oh, so she's in like this sort of internal affairs sort of situation.
Yeah. But I'm just saying like these other three guys.
That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. It didn't occur to me. What did catch me about the scene is that they feel like inmates in a prison.
Yeah.
So the,
well, they all have talking... dehumanized names, right? They
yes.
G68L, mm-hmm. whatever Pershing's name is. So I've got it here. L52, yeah. M34, M40.
Very like THX prisoner outfits, kind of like yeah. Andor had. And
like the just... clones, it's a dehumanizing technique. So it's like, isn't that weird that the Republic used that?
Yeah. It just feels like they're being watched, and like that therapy droid that he talks to, that therapist mm-hmm. that evaluates him basically to see if he's, you know, on program, you know,
parole officer,
very, very Blade Runner. Yeah. Parole officer is yeah. Bingo. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Yeah, it's sort of a, yeah, like a refugee reintegration thing going on. Yeah, I don't know. It hadn't occurred to me that those guys were working with her as part of her whole...
I'll talk about things in the same way and protect her.
Yeah.
We only get the one scene, so it's hard to tell, but I got the vibe that this was something that they've done before.
She's got layers. Like, she's like a triple agent type deal going on, in my opinion, right? Yeah. Like, she's in full control of a lot of things. And to me, that's probably going to lead to some... big theme of like the New Republic being, you know, corrupt and imperfect, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they're trying to do
very easily in Bloodline and in DFA.
Yeah, like I've had a lot of conversations about like the sequel trilogy. You know, for good or ill, I've had a lot of conversations. You know, the sentiment is like, God, they blew that planet up, and like it's just bam, like all these galactic politics and any interest in the galactic politics gets wiped out in favor of the classic sort of rebellion versus tyranny thing, mm-hmm. which works, you know, for The Last Jedi. Well, it certainly
I'm happy
works.
We're getting it now, like with Andor and with sort of a little bit with Kenobi, a little bit with this, you know, it's good. I like it. All right, let's talk yeah. about biscuits. So they kind of throw it out there like, oh, we missed the fit of the uniform. It fit better. And, you know, like everyday stuff, like food. Okay. And he's like, oh, the travel biscuit, the yellow one. All right. What did this say to you?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really think about the color that much, but they are doing some crazy stuff with color in this episode. I'll try not to like jump ahead, but she says, I like the red ones.
Yeah.
All that red going on in this episode.
Red.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you talk to people who have like certain military experiences, you know, they have really fond memories of certain things about life in the military, you know, depending on what their experience was. And then there's like the other kinds of experiences, which are the total opposite, you know, where war is hell, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's going on with the cookies other than, you know, that rose tinted, you know, nostalgia for the past, you know, remember when Star Wars was good, blah, you know, that whole thing, right? Like,
yeah,
it's all, the grass is always greener. Everything was better when I was 7 years old. You know, the Empire would have never let all this garbage happen. At least we, you know, had order and stability and all the, you know, right? Like that kind of thing.
This ties back to the mythosaur. How does it tie back to the mythosaur? When you have a serpent that is not eating its own tail like the Ouroboros, you have an incomplete serpent. All it can do is consume, right? So what does that happen on the micro level with the individual? You are hungry if you have no purpose and you are not in balance. You are missing an aspect of yourself. You are hungry. Mm-hmm. And guess what he's hungry for? Yellow biscuit. He's missing something that had before.
Yeah.
Symbolic.
Yellow is an interesting color. You know, he talked about being from like a little village, you know.
Yellow
makes me think
the color of joy.
Yeah, it makes me think of like Rey's lightsaber or Tatooine or Naboo, you know, Padme's Naboo dress is like yellow, sunshine. Yeah. I don't know. Or like the N1 starfighter used to be yellow and now it's not anymore. So it's nostalgia for the past is what's going on with these Imperials, I think. One would like to hope.
Yeah, we'll see. But essentially, Pershing already recognizes with this like seed that's planted that he's hungry. And the dark side is hungry, right? Because it's always missing that completion, that ability to have rebirth, to be reborn, to have eaten your own tail. You're hungry until you basically eat yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
your own shadow.
If you're a Sith with like a partner, you know, like you're not like, oh, I'm a complete person with like a buddy or a husband or whatever.
You're always trying.
This person's going to kill me one day.
Yeah. You're always trying to consume. You're always trying to hurt. For power. Yeah. And, you know, hey, he's just in hanging out in bed and reading about Coruscant, and he knocked at the door and, oh, look what arrived. The biscuits.
Yeah.
Yeah. This made me feel like Wile E. Coyote leaving like like a Roadrunner bird seed.
Yeah, like I thought you were going to say like the Reese's Pieces for E.T., but it's the same, same deal. Thing.
Like, yeah, like he should have known. Like, nothing is this easy. When it's this easy, it means that, you know, it's the quick and easy path, right? The quick and easy path. No, Pershing. He goes to work. Happy Bendu Day. Bendu.
Yeah, which is sort of what the middle way.
Yeah.
Where things get murky, maybe. I think
it's literally like essentially out of the 5 days, like Prime Day is one and Thong's Day is one and Bendu Day is one. I don't remember all of them. Somebody was tweeting them at me today. But Bendu Day, I think, is directly in the middle. So it's basically Wednesday. Which day is the weekends? They not get weekends. Anyways, there's only 5 days in the galactic.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But she invites him out to go and hang out and do something. And so they go to like kind of a carnival. There's like they're having like glowy popsicles, which is so cool. And bring these to Galaxy's Edge, please.
Yeah. Again, hers is red, I would like to point out, and his is blue.
It is.
Until he panics and drops his and leaves it behind. Anyway, the color thing is so funny to me in this episode because it's so like
apparent.
On compared to like some other stuff. Yeah.
They have carnival music. They're having like a really nice chat about, you know, the surroundings. Wow, it's amazing that, you know, there's a trillion permanent residents here.
Yeah.
I can't even like picture that. Like, it's just unfathomable how much humanity is on top of each other. You know, not much has changed. It did. They just took the cogs off the walls. The Imperial cogs.
Yeah, I love that line, actually. Yeah, that was good. One of my favorite things about Charles Soule's work for Lucasfilm the last like 5, 7, 8 years is his ability to kind of make a stew out of all the different like separate parts of Star Wars and the U-Mate, like the mountain U-Mat? Summit,
yeah,
U-Mat or whatever. Yeah, like I associate that with like Light of the Jedi too, and so it felt like his hands were maybe on this episode a little bit, maybe, potentially. I don't know, that was kind of fun. I think that mountain goes back to George's days, but it just, you know, it's like a big deal in that Light of the Jedi novel. I think that's where like they gave it a name and, you know, kind of went into why it's important to, you know, the Chancellor and, you know, the symbolism of it. And again, I'm obsessed with this sort of, you know, tip of the iceberg image of like, oh, we see like this one little bit of the true Coruscant and everything else is a facade. It's artifice.
I have a lot of thoughts about Umat. But first, I just want to point out that Pershing is the one who brings up that I don't think, like, he is sad that his work went unfinished and that he understands that it wouldn't be something the New Republic would be interested in. So it's probably pretty bad and that the ethics of cloning are complicated. And she says, I'm sure a lot of people would want to help.
Interesting.
But he's the one who actually brings up him being dissatisfied with the situation. After the offer of the biscuits, which is interesting. But they go over to the peak because he's like, what is that? You know, this is so out of place. And it's, you know, it's very like, it fits with the carnival aspect. Like the wild animal or the wildness of Coruscant being surrounded by a fence, essentially.
Yeah.
This is all that remains of what was the wildness of Coruscant, the earth, the deep wild.
Yeah, the natural world, and we cannot touch it. That's so weird.
So she says this is the only place on the planet. Some say that this is the only place on the planet where you can see the planet itself.
Mm.
Such a specific way. So oftentimes the people draw the concept of the self, especially if you come from like a Freudian psychology perspective, as an iceberg, that like there's the stuff that's peeking up over top of the edge, right, that you can actually see, the iceberg image that you were so drawn to with Umat.
Sure.
But it's much deeper and bigger underneath, and it goes so, so deep. Like Jung would say that the self is not really something that you can really quantify. Like there's this quote, intellectually, the self is no more than a psychological concept, a construct that serves to express the unknowable essence, which we cannot grasp as such. Since by definition, it transcends our power of comprehension, it might equally well be called the God within. So Coruscant is both the planet and the things that have been built on top of it. But the true planet, the heart of the planet, is entirely covered with this sort of ego, this persona of what it represents. But the true planet is lost to be able to be touched. Yeah. And you have to touch the planet to be able to grasp it and understand it. And this is really the idea that the heart of the world hasn't been able to be transformed. They haven't deconstructed the city. They haven't made it better. Nothing is really changed on Coruscant whatsoever based on what we've seen. And, the only way that you could actually make this better is that you touch the dirt. You get your hands dirty, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Because if you're not willing to actually do that, then change is just superficial.
Yeah. Luthen Rail in Andor said he wanted things in the galaxy to get worse, to jar mm-hmm. people out of that comfort. And you mentioned the chasm with the mythosaur at the beginning of the episode and just how deep that water goes. And I think there's a line in this episode or maybe last episode about how the mythosaur was kind of maybe lost beneath the surface due to seismic activity, or maybe the implication is that seismic activity, awoke it or freed it from
freed it from its shell. Yeah. Like what I said was like the trauma that you experience actually like loosens up shadows that now live in your subconscious that are there waiting for you.
Sure.
And the power lives in your subconscious. The shadows have power. It's important. So she encourages him to touch it. Why don't you touch it?
Yeah.
Want to touch it? Live a little, Doc. It's not the Empire. So he goes in, and like to me, this was totally a test of him willing to accept her suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He didn't want to. He doesn't want to break the rules on a base level. He's like, nah, I don't want to break the rules. And she's like, push, you can break the rules. And he's like, fine, I'll break the rules. And the droid stops him and he loses his popsicle.
Yeah. And her speech to him here is totally Palpatine to Anakin, Revenge of the Sith, like following orders, like that's no better than the Empire. Mm-hmm. And she says, like, what about trusting your gut? Which is Palpatine tells Anakin, like, don't you? Like, trust your intuition, trust your heart. Except because, he's like a devilish master manipulator. It's look for the dark parts of your heart and like so she's trying to find that thing that, mm-hmm. Like you said, people are very unknowably complex and have all this depth in the unconscious mind. Like, why do they do what they do? She's looking to bring out the worst.
It's interesting, or at least have him lean into his desires, right? Libidinous versus idealistic, to quote John Kasdan.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
Like the power that she's showing him in this episode is like, if you want something, i.e., cookies or cloning or whatever dark thing, you know, you simply take it and like, you yep. know, I'll show
instead
you how.
Instead of he wants to do research, there was probably a way for him to apply and say, hey, under these strict conditions, I'll do this research and I'll be ethically supervised and all of those things. There was probably a way for him to go through the system to do his work in a way that would have been societally accepted. And he took no from a robot, basically.
Yeah.
Instead of like saying, maybe there's a different way. Maybe there's a third path that doesn't involve me going down this dark path.
Yeah.
Hidei meets with the droid. It's one of three times we see the day during this episode, which is really interesting too. He's kind of in shadow, insane all the time. You know, and he asks the droid, the droid asks him like all those questions about like, do you have any resentment towards your coworkers? Are you happy with your assignment and your living condition? And then he's like, if I were to pursue my own research, you know, could I do that recreationally? Little light cloning on the side.
Yeah.
And they've just like classified him as no. And so it's prohibited. And so he's like, oh, I guess my life's work and everything that brought me meaning, right? So when people are hungry, it's also symbolically represents that they are seeking purpose.
Yeah.
The cookies represent purpose, seeking purpose. He's not being fulfilled. And so he is hungry.
And even maybe like dangerous ambition, like the desire for greatness. Like I think yeah. in the novel, The Natural, like before like some big baseball game, like he like can't stop eating, you know, this idea that like it's, ambition
I mean it's
slippery.
Tied to greed, which
yeah
is
sure
very Star Wars, right? Greed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he walks home and there is G68 waiting for him. And what's fascinating is this is written using active listening. And active listening is a technique that counselors use to basically ask questions or use statements to confirm things without actually putting words into the person's mouth. So he says he's very frustrated with the fact that he can't continue his research and kind of is all a waste. And she says, it sounds like you want to continue it. That is literally an active listening way of stating that. It's used in counseling all the time. And he's like, yeah, I do. Like, what do you need to do that? So she asks him that, right? And he answers a mobile station supplies. And then she warns him, well, that would require us to go outside of our designated perimeter, putting it out there. And he's like, well, I can't. He is back at work the next day and behind and, you know, frustrated with the data work and the fact that all of these cool supplies are going to be decommissioned. It feels very, very unfair that nothing of the Empire was of value to the New Republic, including him. He is the metaphorical representation of the decommissioned equipment.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. This idea that everything is going to go to waste and nothing is going to be sort of transformed.
He's being wasted. And so what does he do? Yeah. He eats his cook, which is, I need to consume. I need.
Yeah.
It's so cool. He meets up with the droid and, you know, the droid asks, you know, are you happy with the New Republic? Do you have any resentment towards the New Republic? He pokes his ear and lies.
Nice.
And then he clarifies, but our main objective is to help the New Republic.
That
supersedes everything else. And she says, yes. He heads back to the apartment right away.
He's like, oh, yeah. It's like the Anakin thing of like, well, as long as my intentions are good, it doesn't matter, you know, how many temples I raise to the ground along the way. You know, it's all to save, you know, my wife or, you know, help the Republic.
It's all to make sure that the galaxy is in order, because can you believe that it's not in order?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't have imperfection and I guess like, yeah, like order and security, you know, that fear. You know, a lot of people will fetishize that. So
he knocks on G68's door or rings the doorbell and he's like, the mobile station, let's go get it. And literally, this is when we hear the of Palpatine from the opera house. It's like it's like, oh.
Every time Kane has like a line of dialogue, it's like, oh. So good.
Yeah. I really would like to know if they used actual choral for this because it was so good. I mean, it's deep in there. Like, it's not as apparent as it is in Palpatine's teachings, but this is, it represents temptation in Star Wars. Using this is the ultimate temptation, right? I can give you the power you need. Isn't it easy? Isn't
my
it?
My silly Reddit bro fan theory is that she is of the Sith Eternal cult on Exegol. That's like, you know, their whole purpose. They're like born and raised to, you know, long live the king, and make sure that there's always a Sith in power somewhere in the galaxy. And the,
it always comes back to that.
I don't know. I can't get it out of my head that, like, it's one of those things like I latched onto, and now I have confirmation bias. I'm like, oh, look, I'm right. You know, there's a red light. She's Sith Eternal, just like my very, very tired brain, you know, sleep deprived brain thinks that she's Sith Eternal. So we'll find out. But I think that's, it could be fun potentially, but I don't know.
His instincts are all way out of whack, right? So he's like, yeah, let's go to this disposal yard and pick up this mobile medical station. And so they're heading towards the train. And this is where we are genuinely in like a mini adventurer's journey. I wouldn't even call it heroic.
No, yeah, it's more like running from the,
right,
you know, authority, but
they,
I guess.
They're about to enter into like the castle. They're storming the castle. They're like, we are not allowed in here. And so there's literally guards, right? There's not only sort of like security officers, which are just human, but these very intimidating droids that are almost, they sort of remind me of the machine in Mensch from Metropolis that C-3PO was originally based on. They kind of look kind of like that. The original drawings of C-3PO in the Macquarie art from A New Hope.
I thought the taxi driver looked like like the C-3PO painting.
The droids all kind of have that very like old school vibe to them. But they're twins, right? There's two of them always. And so twin guardians of the threshold cannot be defeated.
Oh, interesting.
So we have several twin guardians throughout myth, right? Double-headed dragons. The biggest one I can think of like that like is more recent is from Labyrinth, where we have the twin-headed like people who guard the door against her going past it, and one speaks lies and one speaks truth. They can't be defeated. They must be tricked. This is key.
Oh, okay.
Right? So the only way you can get past twin guardians is by tricking them. Hercules' sons, Thor's sons, they're considered to be like the strongest people. Hercules' sons, Alexaris and Ancetus. I'm not pronouncing that correctly. I've only read it. Basically, they're considered to be like the strongest people in the world. Like those people guard Olympus as part of their duty. And so like twins themselves are undefeatable through brute strength. And on the train, right? They're on the train and like they see this alien. I love the, and it's Tongs Day, am I right? Tongs Day has got to be like Monday or Tuesday, I don't know.
Yeah,
early in the week. And the guardians approach, or the ticket droids approach, and they literally are like, we have no solution for this, we can't fight them. And so they are like this threat that is ever marching forward, and they're pursued the whole way until they have to do a leap of faith at the end of the train with the ultimate trust me from her. Isn't that so interesting? Essentially, they had to sneak their way in through the back way.
Yeah. And it's that very like industrial, you know, skeletal part of Coruscant that like we associate with like Palpatine and Attack of the Clones again, like at the end of Attack of the Clones, sort of where, I don't know, it feels like that part of Coruscant, like a little bit away from, you know, the opera house and the glitz and glam. It's more of like, you know, just that raw, what, capitalist consumption or that's going on, the industrial, like,
yeah,
yeah, just kind of.
It's also like waste in a way too, which is partially
waste, yeah,
like saying like all of this stuff is just going to be destroyed, we're not even going to utilize all of this stuff that was, you know, maybe a little dark, but sure. Okay. Yeah, of course it was the Empire and the New Republic's sort of modus operandi is to just destroy anything that the Empire touches. You know, you can see why Pershing is like, well, then that's also me, right? So they enter the ship, and of course, this is our threshold finally. And there's like, it's like the guts of the ship are out on display. There's little animals. You can see the little like
I love eyes. Those. Yeah.
And in the dark, she introduces herself. I'm Aliyah Kane, a communications officer. So her name basically means otherworldly, beautiful maiden.
Nice.
From like just the K-A-N-E spelling of Kane and Aliyah. And probably too good to be true, right? So like absolutely siren, femme fatale, you know, untouchable. Fairy maiden is another way of translating Aliyah. And then there's Kane, which of course, from the biblical context to C-A-I-N, you know, is tied with the murder of his younger son Abel, or younger brother Abel, who you know, of course, were the sons of Adam and Eve. And he was cursed. Cain was cursed to never farm again, that like wild element, never farm again, but instead became the first man to establish a city. So this is where I came up with the like tie to her being somebody of Coruscant.
Yeah. The more I think about your comment about earlier in the episode, the more I'm like, you know, she says that she never really got to consider what she wanted to be when she grew up. Like it was always preordained. And so that's sort of where I was like, okay, maybe I'm onto something with the Sith Eternal idea, but you could just as easily say, well, you're right that her parents are just like rich Coruscant assholes. And so to rebel for her was to, you know, be a mover and shaker in the galaxy, whereas they're apathetic and don't want to shake things up.
Or to join the military.
Sure.
As an idea. And he was Dr. Penn Pershing, which is such like I'm 1920s, you know, kind of name.
Sounds like Pin Pusher, which is like what he is, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, sort of. You know, and he talks about his mom and how his mom was, when they arrive at the lab, his mom was a doctor in this small village town that they grew up in, and he grew up in, you know, and that's when Aliyah brings up, you know, didn't have a chance to think about what I wanted to be. And he collects everything he needs, but then there's some sort of movement on the ship and they run to escape and are captured. And we find out that lo and behold, this has all been a setup, entrapment, and Aliyah Kane has betrayed him.
It's very strange. It's such a...
It unmoored me. I was like, wait? I mean, she was suspicious the whole time and it was very subtle, but it really got me.
Yeah. I feel like she's like something more within like sort of internal affairs cop system too.
Yeah, she's not just what she seems on surface with this. There's a she's a spy who's a spy who's a spy or something, you know.
Like Marion Cotillard in the movie Allied, where she's like a mom and she's like a spy for the Allies. And then there's like suspicion that she's like an Axis double agent, but no, she isn't. So, you know, it's like all these layers of like crazy stuff going on.
There's a lot of layers. We get this Mon Calamari who's talking with him. I can't place the elevator music that's in this lab, which again reminds me of Total Recall. But he's like, you know, the adjustment can be difficult. This is a mind flare. He's like, no, this is a 602 mitigator. I've been through it myself. It's quite low voltage. The device is used to heal. I'm like, oh my God, this is Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
And then he says to the Mon Calamari, it was a trap and I died.
Yeah, the trap thing was funny.
But I mean, and it was just Yeah, it was so funny. And you know, so he's like, he's getting his treatment and Elia asks to stay. And the Twi'lek who's in the room, the Twi'lek doctor who's like administering it is like, of course, you know, for every failure, we're so glad we have a success like you.
Yeah.
The 68. And she's like, uh-huh. And then turns up the volume on the mind flare, probably wiping his mind, right? We can assume that that's the outcome of that. And essentially this is a ego death, right? This is he has entered the underworld and this is his lowest possible point, and he is experiencing a death of everything that he knew. And she eats a biscuit. So she's not good. She's not the Republic.
Yeah.
So why this? Why show us this, Alex Kane? Alex Kane.
Yeah, yeah.
Thus,
suddenly, I'm really suspicious now. It's like they said back in like September of 2019 that the Mandalorian would like explore the origins of the First Order, and then they showed us like those goofy like proto Snoke clones in like season yeah. 2, and everybody's like, what the hell is that, like, and then they sort of, we just sort of moved on from that and went and explored Boba Fett and the Empire and other things that were more interesting at the time, I guess. And then now we're sort of getting back to this idea of like, okay, you know, maybe we should, you know, remember that the sequel trilogy exists and lay some groundwork for, you know, what that galaxy is going to look like. And
but it has to tie into where we're going from a Mandalorian perspective, right? Like, we know we're getting Paul Sung-Hung Lee in the season. So do you think that like he calls him in to help? I mean, he's been chasing him.
You see here.
He was one of the like cops in the other room.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Carson. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Carson. That's the Carson name.
Yeah, he's great. Love him. Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, maybe they are using threads from that Rangers of the New Republic show. That could be, you know, like taking the spinoff and
they wrote season 3 and then they just like decided to put Rangers of the Outer Rim in amidst them. I don't know.
You know, it wouldn't be the first time that Star Wars has taken material from one thing and repurposed it. Like, I think some of the stuff from like the writer's room that George had in like 2004 or 5 for like Underworld, I think they took that and put it into, you know, Solo and other stuff. So, I mean, there's precedent for using old bits. And, you know, I think Dave Filoni is kind of the invisible guiding hand through a lot of this sort of Mandoverse stuff, since it's leading to whatever, Ahsoka and Thrawn and God knows what else, like Rebels 2, basically. But yeah, this episode does a fair job of like drawing parallels between the two journeys as being, you know, two sort of individuals being seduced potentially into these, you know, sort of new stages, new paths.
Living in caves, i.e. the underworld.
Yeah. And just like the children of the watch as being like sort of static, you know, people who love the status quo and dogma, much like Coruscant society wants status quo and dogma, I guess, right? Like, they want to live comfortably.
I'm going to say, I can tell you exactly what it's saying, but I can't tell you why, right? Okay. I can't tell you why this is being said in this way. I hope it ties into Din and Bo and Grogu and what they're doing. It really feels like we're talking about not even New York City, but like New York City in the 2020s versus the Wild West. Like, that's how far.
Interesting.
You know, yeah. Like, it just feels like those stories are so disparate and different. And I don't know how they're going to come together to like have it pay off that this was the story that they were telling now. I'm excited to find out how they do it. I just don't know that I'm interested in the answers, but I'm not like, like I need to know these answers. To me, they just feel like, well, that was an interesting cut to 200 years in the future.
Sure. Yeah.
From the Wild West that we were hanging out in.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like a different show within the show.
I mean, we got that with Boba Fett, so
yeah. It didn't really like bother me the first time I was watching it. I think the second time you definitely see the how it's almost like an episode and a half, and yeah. Like kind of you don't quite get that resolution you want.
Like maybe they cut like a scene from Mando that would have been a normal like half an hour, 35 minute episode and added in like this episode that they recorded of Rangers
of the Outer Rim. Interesting.
I don't know. It just feels disconnected unless it's meant to connect later. And then it's fine. Yeah. I don't care. But it just feels like modern day New York City and the Wild West are both sharing time on the same show.
Yeah. I mean, there is that kind of like outer rim core world divide.
Yeah.
That, you know, isn't exactly brand new.
I'm okay with that as long as they figure out a way to bring us back plot wise and like, you know, character wise, and that this ties to something that we need to understand or know.
I mean, I guess Grogu has all that Order 66 trauma, and that's Coruscant, which is interesting.
Yeah. We also have history with Pershings and Grogu and, you know, and Din, and there's stuff there. Certainly. I don't know what we're going to do with Tabula Rasa Pershing now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's weird for sure. I guess you got IG-11 had that sort of journey in season one.
But are we ever going to go back and get him?
And then, we brought him up again. Yeah. I don't know.
Does he even matter anymore?
I don't know.
Now that we have RG or R5, do we care about him? Or was that all just an elaborate plot to make sure that the N1 starfighter could drive itself?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So that Grogu could go get Bo, so we could go get Bo and have Bo in the show.
Yeah, I don't know.
Did we really just do all of that just to bring Bo into the show when he could have just shown up on our doorway with beer and a pizza?
Yeah, I don't know. They were really talking about IG-11, and then we kind of couldn't explain it fully at the time.
And now we don't care.
Yeah. Unless
he's going to randomly find the IG chip and it's going to make a difference for him in carrying Grogu.
He did say he wanted the Jawas to look for it, maybe.
Like maybe, something. Yeah, I don't know. Does he care anymore about his friends? I
don't know. We're not getting a lot of Din the last couple episodes.
I just, he's a damsel right now. He's a maiden. Yeah. He's a baby. He's a child. He went back to mama. Let's talk about that. Back to the covert. Where are you taking me? Home to mother.
Yeah.
By the way, when we meet my mother, it would be best if you kept your helmet on. I don't know about you, but when I first met my significant other's parents, there was a weird, like, by the way, my parents are super weird about shoes.
Oh, sure.
Don't take your shoes off in the house.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. There's always those weird little things that people have, like this little.
But didn't it give you that vibe?
Yeah. Like sort of ritual of control and like.
But it's like I'm about to introduce you to my mother.
Sure. Yeah.
He's so happy to have brought Bo back and to have like, you know, but he's like, everything will go smoother if you keep your helmet on. It's like, We get this look at them leaving the ships and it's mom and daddy and baby makes three.
Yeah. It's interesting. You've got like Bo and Favreau's character, Paz Vizsla, kind of like the two sort of nobility characters. Of course, you talked about your theory that maybe Din is like secret prince or something, which I love. And then you've got these two like very strong feminine leader figures, like, right, sort of. With the armor and bow. And so there's all this like drama that's going to be coming, right? With like Paz being like the grumpy masculine guy who's going to be like, you know, I have all these ideas about what your clan is. And then it's a fun dramatic powder keg that we haven't really seen yet.
I love it so much because we have the prodigal son effectively returning.
Yeah.
Right. Paz like, I was the one who never took off my helmet and stayed here. And I was super loyal and all these good things. And the armor's like, you suck.
Yeah. And we already got like a lot of build up for Paz to be like the sort of angry, jealous, a spot. Like, he's an ambitious guy, you know, who challenged Din in what was that, Book of Boba Fett episode 6 or something, where they had like a sword fight over like space, I think. So we might get more of that drama coming back.
That would be great. I also expect to see some sort of standoff between the armorer and Bo. I don't think it'll be as dramatic as, like, I don't know, a fight or anything like that. I just think that there's going to be some posturing, because Bo obviously cares about Din and is willing to go back to his cave home with him.
Yeah.
With his small son, his small green son.
Yeah.
There's a lot. This episode was a lot. What a weird episode. I don't know. I enjoyed it in the end, but I also don't even know why.
Yeah. There's just like a lot of substance and a lot of good directing.
There's a lot to eat, but I don't know what I'm eating.
It doesn't sing yet. Yeah. And it might, maybe it will later when puzzle pieces click together.
That's the hardest thing about covering a show week to week, right? Is like, what did this even mean? Oh.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say better writing indicates what it means earlier. But there's still a lot of really cool things that happened in this episode that I think you and I both really appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I don't know if it was like to the level of like the previous one, because that was like kind of an all-time high for me in Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. But I appreciated just sort of getting surprise Coruscant jump scare, like, oh, we're here. Okay. Didn't expect that.
Yeah. Jump scare is a really good way to put it. Yeah. I called it whiplash, but that's just me.
Yeah. It totally was. Totally was. And because this whole show, I mean, we're basically on the fourth season of these Mandoverse shows, I think, by now. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like, this is the first time that we're like, okay, we're going to look at the core world galactic canvas, you know.
Post Return of the Jedi, the first time we've seen Coruscant since then.
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, it's like, it's very,
it's been 40 years. I mean, not really, but yeah, really.
Yeah. It's like, it's sort of like the wealthy, apathetic, sort of the people who have a lot of power and don't sort of care who it hurts, versus like the other shows or other episodes are sort of like the little people on the fringes of society, you know, surviving, more of a like blue collar type of, you know, like where Pershing comes from, according to his narrative, if we want to believe everything he says.
Ear rub.
It's an episode where you kind of don't trust anything you hear, which is fun. Yeah. I don't know. I like that aspect of it.
I appreciate unreliable narrators a lot. So there was a lot of weirdness in this episode. And you know what? I like when Star Wars makes me uncomfortable to some extent. So I'm good with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Alex, we've been talking for a really long time, so I'm going to let you and I wrap up. Where can people find you if they're looking for you before next week's episode?
I'm on Twitter at Alex J. Kane, K-A-N-E, like Aliyah Kane, apparently.
Oh my goodness. Are you going to betray me again, Alex?
Yeah. I'm going to rat you out to the cops. Yeah.
All right. Thanks again for joining me, Alex, and we will see you all next week for another episode of Once Upon a Time in the Outer Rim. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is provided by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We would like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force: Melody, Night Huntress, In Wild Space, How Rude, Anna Perez, Neil, Christian Luca, Josh Johnson, Scott C, and Susan. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube, or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or other pod apps. It helps people find the show. Check out our other channel on YouTube, What the Fiction. You can connect with us on Twitter at WTForceShow, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, and our website, whattheforce.ca. We also have a Discord. Links are in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.